Good evening again, everyone. Thank you for coming to Wat Chet Awan tonight for Dharma Talk by Ajahn Brahmavamsa. And most of you are aware that we have a 9-day retreat here right now. The evening Dharma Talks are open to public. So the people who are having, you know, red lanyard, they are the retreatants. They are also practicing noble silence. So if they're your friend, they could be a little bit unsociable tonight. So just thanks for your understanding on that. Yeah. We are very honored to have Ajahn Brahm here to give a talk. And those who want to know him better can read his bio data, which is posted on the door outside. All the details of where he was born and studied, became a monk, and where he is at today. Ajahn will give a talk for about 1 hour, and then will be followed by Q&A, questions and answers, for about 30 minutes. We try to finish tonight by about 9:30. Because in consideration for the yogis as well as Ajahn to take rest, so they are continuing with their retreat for the next few days. Yeah, some of them may want to continue meditation as well. So without further ado, let's put our palms together and invite Ajahn Brahm to give the talk tonight on Sama Sankappa, or right intention.
Very good. So it's good to let me have a rest, because I'm getting old now. Old monks, they need to be preserved. You've lost too many old monks in Malaysia, so the ones you've got left, please look after them. And this evening's talk is about right intention, Sama Sankappa, in a talk about the Eightfold Path. And the intention is, by the end of these 8 talks, when you've learnt and practiced the Eightfold Path, you should all be fully enlightened, because that's what the Buddha said, anybody who practices the Eightfold Path will be enlightened. So if by the end of this retreat you are not enlightened, you can ask for your money back. You won't get your money back, but you're always allowed to ask for it. That's why these talks sometimes, you know, to raise more money, we say, no, we can't actually charge to come in for a talk. That's wrong. That's not according to the Dhamma. So what we are thinking of doing is, you don't charge to come in, but to get out, you have to pay. But of course, that is things too sneaky. And the talk about this evening is right intention. It's one of those parts of the Eightfold Path which is not talked about enough, which is not explained, and so it becomes the unknown factor of the Eightfold Path. Right intention. And as you should know, the intention is the most important part of anything. It's what you intend. That way your mind and your body follows. So if you know what right intention is, skillful intention, and you get that right, everything else follows accordingly. And I use this especially in meditation, which I'll come up to later on in this talk, saying if you understand what right intention is, then the whole of meditation becomes very clear. What you're supposed to do, and why people sometimes make mistakes and don't enjoy the bliss of meditation. But let's go to the beginning, the right intention. There are 3 right intentions. The intention of renunciation, letting go, giving up. The intention of kindness, of love, of compassion. And lastly, the intention of gentleness, non-violence. In Pali, it's nekama, renunciation, letting go. Avayapada, otherwise known as metta, loving kindness. and lastly, Ahimsa, which Mahatma Gandhi made very famous, the path of non-violence. So what do we mean by each one of these? First of all, the path of letting go. And we all know that's such an important part of meditation, to let go. So in my monastery in Perth, we do not have donation boxes. We don't have donation boxes. Instead, we have letting go boxes. We can let go because, you know, this is science. I was a scientist before. One of the wonderful things about Buddhism, it is confirmed by science. Modern science tells you exactly what meditation is and how it makes all sorts of things happen. Like the latest research showed the mitochondria, the end of those, when they start fraying, that's called old age. And when you actually meditate, they actually are preserved much longer. So when you meditate, you don't get old. Now sometimes people think I'm only 60. You wouldn't believe if I tell you I was 110, would you? You won't believe that because it's wrong anyway. But all of you ladies especially, it means you don't have to go to makeovers. You don't have to have Botox. You don't have to have, you know, these uplifts to parts of your body. You meditate. And when you meditate, you know, those things can actually be levitated. What's that old joke about the old lady? There was an old lady, she was maybe in her 70s, she'd just lost her husband, and she was so depressed without him, she decided she didn't really want to live, so she wanted to commit suicide. So she got her husband's old gun. You know, he had a gun, and she wanted to shoot herself, you know, in the heart, that's instant death. But she didn't really know where the heart was. So she called one of her friends who was a doctor. Said, where is the heart? He said, it's just below your breast. So she shot herself in the knee. That's what happens when you get old. You know that. But my intention is learning how to let go of everything and be peaceful. Then you have all these wonderful benefits. So the first thing we have to renounce in the Eightfold Path is all those things which create problems for us. Let go of all your difficulties and problems in life. Why can't we do that? Very strange, I've been telling people today. When you remember your past, what do you remember? Mostly all the things which went wrong. Can't you let that go? I like to talk to people about the simile of the photo album. Because many of you have got photo albums. Somebody gave me a photograph yesterday about, was it today? I don't know. When you live in the present moment, you don't really know whether it's today or yesterday or the future or whatever. But anyway, of, you know, when I had my 60th birthday with my brother. It's a nice photograph seeing me, my brother and my sister-in-law. We like to keep happy photographs. And I've been to many people's houses and I've seen usually the photograph of when they got married. They see the photograph of them. Usually when you get to college, you get your degree. You know, your parents on either side, and there is you in this funny hat, like a penguin, receiving your... But now that's a happy photograph. You see the photograph when you're on holiday overseas. See, all these happy photographs, which you have in your house and your albums. But I've never, ever gone to somebody's house and seen a photograph of their divorce. I've never seen a photograph of them doing their homework. I've never seen a photograph of you stuck in the traffic in KL on the way to work. You have the happy photographs. And why do you have photograph albums with the happy photographs? Because whenever you're feeling a bit depressed or a bit down, you could open up that album and you have all these happy memories. Oh yeah, that was me when I was at university. You know, look, that was 30 years ago and I haven't changed. Look at me, that's with my lovely wife when we first get married. Oh, she was so beautiful then. Shame I can't do an exchange somewhere, but anyway. Look at that. That was when we were on holiday overseas. Wasn't that wonderful memories? Because when you look at those photograph albums with the beautiful photographs, it gives you a lot of happiness and joy. And we don't keep the ugly photographs, the ones of when we're in trouble, suffering. You've never seen a photograph of someone when they're in hospital, sick. Those are happy photographs, because the happy photographs uplift us. They cause us positive energy, happiness, and we share that happiness with other people because we're nicer people to live with. So there's another photographic album which we have inside here. And unfortunately, that one, we keep a lot of unpleasant photographs. The photograph of when somebody cheated on you, or when they called you a pig, or when they smashed your car, or they stole something from your house. How many people when somebody died? Why do we keep the unpleasant photographs in our head? So the first thing we should do in renunciation, please renounce, let go of all the unpleasant memories in your life so far. There is inside your brain the delete button. Delete, delete, delete. On the computer, that is my favorite button. The renunciation button. Delete, delete, delete. Because when you do that, all these old emails, I don't know where they're from, they're probably from the BTF, I don't know. Delete, 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 delete. And they all disappear. And that means you renounce, and so you're peaceful. You don't have any bad memories. You don't have any fears of the future. Let go of all the anxiety about what will happen next. Who knows what's going to happen next? In fact, so many of the things which I was worried about, they didn't happen. Usually, something else happened. Often, something worse. Which is why I said that saying of mine, never do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight. You don't know what's going to happen in the future. So learn how to live more in the present moment and let go of all your future concerns and worries. We carry them too much. So much so that people are so anxious in our modern world. They're so worried about what might happen that it causes them psychological stress. It causes them ill health. And the things they were worried about, they wouldn't have happened if they'd learned how to let go and enjoy this moment. So the first things we renounce are the past and the future. And science has told us that that creates a lot of peace and a lot of happiness. What else can you renounce? What else you can renounce is what other people think of you. I don't know what other people think of you, but some people think I'm a saint. Other people think I'm the most stupidest guy on earth. Sometimes when you go on airports and people look at you and they think, my goodness, he's got a robe on, he must be terrorist. But then I tell them, no, monks don't wear underpants, so we can't get a bomb anywhere. You can have good fun as a monk going all over the place and letting go of things. Because sometimes that, you know, you get into situations, you know, and you just let go when people sort of start criticizing you and they start calling you bad names. You let go of what people say about you. What do they know about you anyway? How can they know who Ajahn Brahm is? It's taken me many years to find out who I am. How can they know?
So whatever anybody says about you, please let it go. Renounce what other people say so you can be free. And you're not concerned about being controlled by other people's expectations. You do what you feel is right. Not what other people, not just trying to please other people. Otherwise you'll spend all your life trying to please others. And that's so much stress for you. Instead, be yourself. Relax and be free. And that way actually you please many more people. So we let go of all of this. And also, we just renounce, as I've been telling earlier, all those bad things which we can do in life. That's why we keep precepts. We renounce things like alcohol. But the trouble is, people know that renunciation, letting go, is part of Buddhism. But they don't know what letting go means. Because one of my friends, a disciple in Perth, an Australian man, he became very inspired by Buddhism. And he came up to me once and he had learnt a lot of Buddhism. He asked for the five precepts. And I gave him those five precepts. And over in Australia, if someone asks for the five precepts, it's not just for one day. It's not just for, you know, the holy day. It's for life. So over there, if you take the five precepts, it's for life. No Mickey Mouse things over there. Same if you ordain. Sometimes people have asked me, can you do temporary ordinations in my monastery in Perth? And yes, we do temporary ordinations now. You ordain until you die. That's as temporary as I can do. That's temporary. But the precepts you keep forever until you die. And this guy, he came and told me, he said it was so difficult. Because when he went to a party, like at Christmas or New Year, people are always offering you some alcohol to drink. And he told his friend who offered him sort of a beer or, you know, some wine. And he said, no, I can't take that. I'm a Buddhist now. And people know enough about Buddhism in Australia. I think it's the second religion next to Christianity. You know, about 2.5% of the population. That was a year ago, probably more by now. I'm very happy that the number of Buddhists in Australia, we had the result of our census last in August, and the number of Buddhists increased quite considerably. I was very relieved, because if it hadn't increased, I would have lost my productivity bonus. I wouldn't have reached my sales figures. But anyway, it did increase. And so many people, if they're not Buddhist, at least they know what Buddhism is. And so, the fellow serving him alcohol, oh, you're a Buddhist. That's wonderful. Buddhism teaches you letting go. Come on, let go and have a drink. And people think that that's letting go. That's not letting go. So he had a big trouble. But you know his solution afterwards? He told me that it didn't work the first time. But the next time he went to a party, he just telling other people you're a Buddhist didn't work. So the next time he went to a party, he said, I found a solution. When somebody offered me a drink, I said, I'm sorry, I cannot drink because of doctor's orders. I know people accept that. If it's doctor's orders, oh, you poor thing, you must be sick, there's something wrong with you, you can't have alcohol. And they don't argue about that. He said it worked every time. And then I asked him, and said, hang on, aren't you breaking one precept to keep another one? You're lying, there's nothing wrong with you, you're in good health. And that's when he reminded me that he knew more about Buddhism than I did. He said, what do you mean, it is doctor's orders? Because in the suttas, the Buddha often compared himself to a doctor. It was Dr. Buddha's orders. So you can always tell people, if you give out alcohol and you go to a party, don't say because you're a Buddhist. Sometimes people won't accept that. But say it's doctor's orders.
Dr. Buddha's orders. And then I'll accept that.
So we let go of these things. We renounce them. Now, why do we renounce these things? We renounce these things because it creates peace and happiness and harmony in our life. As I said yesterday, right view, what the teaching of Buddhism is whatever leads to peace, to happiness, to harmony, the sense of freedom. That's why we renounce these things, because it leads to greater peace and happiness and freedom and harmony. So that's what we renounce for. It works. And certainly in my life as a monk, actually before I was a monk, was a layperson, I did this for fun. I kept the five precepts for fun. I became a monk for fun. I keep on doing things for fun. I come here to KL to teach for fun. When you do good karma, you have fun. I tell a lot of people, I am a good time monk. I have a good time. You know why? Because if you want a good time, then be good. That's having a good time. So this is what renunciation really means. Now, if you want to go further in renunciation, more than just ordinary fun, to very, very deep states of peace, why don't we renounce all of our attachments? Let them all go, because the opposite of renouncing is called attaching. So there's the old simile, now from way back, of how we used to catch monkeys. And it was very easy in the old days to catch a monkey. All you needed to do was to go into the forest, into the jungle, and find a coconut on the ground. And you'd put a little hole in the coconut, drink the coconut water, and maybe some of the coconut flesh inside. And once you'd eaten the coconut, you'd find a string and tie the coconut to a tree with a stout rope. And then just put a banana inside the coconut. Now the trick was, the hole had to be just the right size, so a monkey could put their paw in, but couldn't pull the paw out with a banana inside the paw. And you just leave it there and go home and have a nice evening, and sure enough, a monkey would find that banana inside the coconut and put his little hand inside. And of course, he could put his hand inside, but holding the banana, now his hand was too big to pull out. And all night he'd be trying to find a way to get that banana out, but he could not do it. And even when the hunter came, what did the monkey do? He just tried even harder to get that banana out. And all he needed to do was to let the banana go, and he could run away and escape. And there were so many other bananas in the forest. But he couldn't let go of that banana. You know why? Because it's my banana. I found it and it's mine. And even though the hunter came very close, there's no way the monkey would let it go. Because of attachment. Because it's mine. Even though it's going to cause that monkey to be captured, maybe killed, or put in some circus or zoo and lose its freedom. The monkey couldn't let go because it was mine. Now you know the story of your life. How many times when somebody, say, gets sick or dies, you can't let them go? Why? Because it's my mother, my father. Even though it caused you so much distress, grief, suffering, why can't we just let it go? And then, just like that monkey, we could let the banana go and just walk away with freedom. It's very hard for us to let things go, to renounce, when we think it is mine. Your relations, your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your husband, your children, are they really mine? do they really belong to you? You've had many mothers and fathers in life. Why do you think this one is yours? It does not belong to you. It belongs to nature. When nature wants to take their body away, it will do. Whether you object or not, it's part of nature. That's why we have to let it go. We have to renounce. They're dead anyway. Why are you crying so much? Why are you suffering so much? Is that what your mother and father would want you to do? If your mother and father would come back as a ghost, silly daughter, stop crying so much. Because you think it's yours, that's why you can't let it go. We don't own these things. The only thing we do own, we don't own our husband, our wife, we don't own our children, we don't own our parents. The only thing we do own is our karma. That's our only possession. So please look after that. Care for that. Other people who come into your lives, we have to let them go. To renounce. It's a wonderful thing when you can do that. I can say that very easily because my mother died last February. And so many people came up to me and said, oh, I'm terribly sorry to hear that, Ajahn Brahm. What do you mean, terribly sorry? Would you be sorry to hear that someone has just been released from jail? I'm terribly sorry you're free now. No! She had Alzheimer's disease for about 3 years. She didn't even recognize who I was. Even though I was the only person dressed like this who would come and visit her. I thought she'd remember me dressed like this. But know what Alzheimer's is, you don't know who's who. A funny thing about that, it's part of letting go. One of the nice things about the facility, the home in which she was living, because she needed 24 hours care. When I went to visit her once, my brother who came with me, notice she was wearing a dress which didn't belong to her. Because in that facility, so many women, because of Alzheimer's disease, they didn't recognize whose dress belonged to whom. So they just see one they liked, and if it fit, they would wear it. So someone else was wearing my mother's dress. She was wearing somebody else's dress. It was wonderful sharing. Why can't we do that? So when you go out, if you see a pair of shoes you like, they're better than yours. It's sharing! Because you can't remember which one is yours. So there's some nice things about that, but obviously, now when there's not really much quality of life, you don't know really what you're doing and who's around you. It was a great relief. A great relief when she passed away. So personally, I was very happy. At last, my mother is released from that terrible prison of forgetfulness where she doesn't know who she is and who anyone else is. What a wonderful thing that is. It was like being released from prison. So when we understand some of these things about death, I always look at the positive side of death, and that helps you let go of things. People who die young, and for me now about 60, young is about 50, or... It's wonderful. Think of all the things you escape. No old age, no Alzheimer's, arthritis, all these other diseases which old people have to deal with. You get out of that by dying young, you lucky thing. So you can always look at the positive side of life instead of worrying about. Now, don't you want to go to heaven or go to enlightenment? So, why are you worried about living and living and living and living? If you were going to go on holiday overseas to this beautiful, the Venerable was saying that he knows some Buddhists over in Cayman Islands. Beautiful places. I think there was some people in the, not in the Maldives, was it, not the Maldives, it's somewhere in the Indian Ocean, some idyllic island, and I heard there were some Buddhists there. And they invited me. You would like to come and teach a retreat. at this beautiful, what's it called? Mauritius, that's it, in Mauritius. There were some Buddhists there. Would you like to teach a retreat in Mauritius? We'll pay your airfare, put you in a nice hotel, and all you need to do, give a few talks in the morning, the rest of the day you can be on the beach, meditating of course. Wouldn't that be a lovely thing to do? If that was you, wouldn't you look forward to that? And all expenses paid, holiday to Mauritius? You'd be counting the days, only 2 weeks to go, only 5 days to go. You get so excited. What's better, heaven or Mauritius? So a person who really understands these things, the closer they get to death. Doctor says only 5 days to go. I can't wait. Doctor says only 3 days to go. Yes, 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 yes. But did you hear? I'm sure I told this last time I was here, but I'm getting old, so I can't remember too, about the guy who went to the doctor, and the doctor said, I'm sorry, your cancer is terminal. And he said, terminal? How long have I got to live? He said, 10. What do you mean, 10? 10 years? 10 months? 10 days? And the doctor said, 9, 8, 7, 6. That's terminal. So, when we learn to let things go, we can have much more fun in life. And even let go of all these fears of life and death. It's like how we live, not how long we live, which is important. And this is why all these intentions, if we have the right intention, the way we live and the way we die, we find we live and die very peacefully and very well. We can let go. And the other thing about dying, remember when it's your time, please let go of your body. Don't keep clinging to it. If you really think your body belongs to you, then just like that monkey in the banana, you won't be able to let it go. And you'll be clinging and clinging and clinging to the very end and having far too much suffering. So when it's time to go, let go of the banana and go away. Die. And it's the same with your relations. The people you love the most, you have to learn how to let them go. And one of the best ways of doing that is before they die, go up to them and give them permission to die. This first became clear to me when I was counseling a fellow called Steve. He was an American marrying to an Australian girl called Jenny, a nurse. And they were really young. I think he was in his mid-30s when he got cancer, and he died about a year later. And he was getting so close to death, I went to the house to counsel him. And I was really surprised he hadn't died yet, until I realized what the problem was. He was suffering. He was really thin and weak and in pain. Why hadn't he died? And I turned to his wife, Jenny, and told her, have you given Steve permission to die yet? She never answered me because she realized that that is what was giving Steve, keeping Steve there. He could not die until he had permission from the person he loved the most and who loved him the most. Because you know, when you're about to die, the last thing you want to do is to hurt the people who love you so much. So I always remember this. I'll remember this to the day I die. Jenny jumping up on the bed, putting her hands around the frail, wasted body of the man she loved and married, looking into his eyes and saying, Steve, I give you permission to die. Don't keep struggling for me. It's all right. And they hugged. The next morning he was dead. That's all he needed. So a lot of times, you know, your family, maybe your mother, your father, kids or whatever, sometimes they keep holding on to that banana because they don't want to hurt you. And all you need to do is to tell them, I give you permission to die. I let you go. Go with my blessing. Fly. And then they can go. And I've done that so many times. And it's so beautiful. Then people can die at peace. they know that you have let them go. And then they can go. That's what we mean by this renunciation. And when you get many times in life, we have to learn how to let things go. We can't control the world. Sometimes the world does its thing, whether we like it or not. And the only thing we can do is to just renounce. Even some of your material possessions. I said, you think they're yours. They don't belong to you. The bank crashes. Bye-bye all my money. You know, something happens, there's a flood or an earthquake, and there goes your home. Bye-bye. You only have these things for a time. So there is an opportunity. There must come a time when you have to let everything go. I remember this story of a fellow called Patrick. And he came to our monastery the first year it was being built and helped out a lot. He was one of these men who was spiritual. He didn't matter what type of religion. Would always be going to stay in monasteries and temples and ashrams, helping out, staying there, and after a while going to another place. The only possession he had in life, I didn't tell anything about a family, he didn't have any wife or girlfriends. The only thing he had, the thing he loved the most, was his Harley Davidson bike. And some of those Harley Davidsons are worth a lot of money. He really was attached to that Harley Davidson, not because it was a great bike, but it gave him the freedom. Whenever he wanted, he'd get on his bike and just go to the other end of Australia. It gave him freedom. And after visiting my monastery, he went to Sydney, and he wrote this letter to me that he was shopping in one of the big shopping malls in Sydney. He'd parked his Harley in the car park, went down to do the shopping, and when he came back, he found the parking bay was empty. Someone had stolen his Harley. And that was the only possession he had in life. And he was so shocked. But then, because of all the teachings of Buddhism he had heard, he managed to let it go. He wrote that he really did this. He said, well, you don't earn anything in life. Now someone else has got that Harley. Really, honestly, I wish them that they have as much happiness with this bike as I had. Thank you so much, this little Harley, for giving me so much joy over the years. Now it belongs to someone else. Please you take it and enjoy it. And he was so happy and proud that he could actually let something go. He actually did that. And he felt, wow, all these teachings I've been listening to over the years actually work. It's been stolen, I've lost it, you can't get it back. And now I'm not suffering. I'm just having this beautiful compassion. Whoever's got it, may they be happy and well. And he was so proud of himself, he passed a very hard test. And as he was patting himself on the back, that's when he realized he was in the wrong level of the car park. You know, they all look the same. And of course, when he went to the correct level, his Harley Davidson was still there. So he won twice there. You know, he still had his Harley, but he managed to let it go at the same time. And he thought, what a wonderful thing this teaching is. All these things, it's gone, why suffer about it? Just wish the thief happiness and well-being. Isn't that what a Buddhist should do? And you could actually do it. And that's part of renunciation. So you renounce these things, then you don't suffer so much. And again, the only thing you do have is your karma. But the real renunciation of letting go happens when you learn how to sit down and cross your legs and meditate. Because you all hear, those of you on this retreat, the only thing I've ever really taught you so far is how to let go. Let go of everything. And especially, let go of this person inside, always controlling things. It's amazing what happens when people stop controlling. I'm not sure if this happens over in Malaysia, but certainly in Australia, sometimes there are power outages. And the intersections of major roads, the traffic lights stop, they don't work. And everybody knows that when the traffic lights go out, the traffic flows more freely. People give and take, and then they don't have to wait at this red traffic light when there's no traffic coming in the opposite direction. And even better than that, there was this story from Jerusalem a few years ago when the doctors went on strike for 2 weeks. The doctors didn't do any operations or any work. The nurses had to look after everybody. And in those 2 weeks, when the doctors weren't at work, the death rate plummeted. People were far healthier when the doctors weren't interfering. And that's true. I've got the paper in my monastery. Are there any doctors here? You're doing a wonderful thing, not working for 9 days. That's true story. Why is that happening? Because a lot of times, if you learn how to let things go, it's amazing just how people become healthy. This is something which happens in meditation. I've seen this many times. When people get into a peaceful meditation, when they're really letting go, strange things happen to your body. I remember seeing this one lady. She was meditating, and she started sitting in a good posture, and then she started to twist and contort. And I cannot tell you, the posture was something like this, multiplied by 3. And I was really concerned for this lady, because I thought she's going to damage something, break some bones, or sitting like that for, 45 minutes. Afterwards, she'd be in great pain. So as soon as the meditation finished, I took her aside and said, "Are you okay?" "I feel great," she said. I said, "You were really contorted. I've never seen anybody twisted that much in meditation." And she said she felt wonderful. And then she told me that she had a very bad car accident a few years ago. And she'd been in aches and pains. And after that experience, she never felt so healthy and free of pain. That told me that she'd been letting go, and the body had done that all by itself. When she let go of control, the body knew what to do. How to move so no chi or energy can flow to the parts which are needed. Your body knows what to do much better than you. So if you can get out of the way and just let your body twist or do whatever it needs to do, you will feel much better. Because the body knows what it needs to do, but you keep stopping it because you're a control freak. And I've seen that so many times when people let go and are peaceful. Even blockages in the body get released. A very common thing in meditation is to get what we call hot spots in the body. And there's many times this happened, but the classic case was when a woman came up to me after the meditation and said it was really strange. She had almost like a fever in her shoulders and neck. It was really hot. Not just warm, but like almost burning, but pleasantly so. And so straight away I told her, "When did you have your whiplash?" And she put her hands up. "Ajahn Brahm, I always knew you could read minds and had psychic powers. Now I have the proof. I never told you that. And that's true. I had a car accident last year and I had whiplash." And I said, "I'm sorry, it's not psychic powers. Because I know that during meditation, when you let go, healing happens. And the most common injury to the neck and shoulders is whiplash in car accidents. So I was just adding one and one and making two. Just being rational. I wasn't reading your mind." And I said, "This is what happens. You've had that injury to your back and your neck. And because of the tightness in your body, because you control so much, you haven't been able to let go. Because of that, healing has never been able to occur. Now in this meditation, you've really let go. You've renounced control. And now the energy has managed to get to that place for the first time since your injury. And the warmth, the heat you felt there is the healing going on. Well done. You've really helped your body." So if any of you during meditation have hot spots in your body, never think that something is going wrong. That's always a very good sign of healing going on in your body. But it only will happen when you let go, you renounce, you stop controlling things. That's when you allow the body to relax enough so the energy can flow freely. That's why renouncing is such a beautiful thing to do. But the most amazing thing, this is for the meditation, is when you truly let things go, that is when you become peaceful. We control so much, we don't allow even our mind to relax. All of this meditation is about being still. Remember, sometimes I used to read these books about people who'd meditate up in the mountains, the hermits in deep caves. And I had this idea of being so peaceful, and so still, when nothing would move. And I realized that that is what this meditation is all about. Real deep peace, where there's no sound, there's no movement, everything is still. The only way that you can get to such a place, if you control and do things, you are the problem. You make the noise. You disturb things. To renounce is to renounce all of your wanting, all of your will. I've been telling this anecdote from Ajahn Chah during the interviews, and I determined I'd say it now so I don't have to repeat it another time. I get my hand up. Now, I'm not waving you goodbye. It's not time yet. This was Ajahn Chah. He would say, this represents a leaf on a tree, and the only reason why it moves up and down is because of the wind. When that wind stops, the leaf moves less and less and less until it's perfectly still, because that's the natural state of a leaf, to be still. It only moves because of the wind. And Ajahn Chah used to say, that's the same as your mind. Its natural state is to be perfectly still. It only moves because of your wanting, control, will. And if you can just somehow stop that, your mind will move less and less until it becomes perfectly still, because that is its natural state. So that's why we learn in meditation to renounce. To renounce all your goals and aspirations. Renounce all your judging of what's good and bad in meditation. Renounce everything, especially all of your wants and your will, and let it go. Then you'll find the wind stops, and your mind moves less and less and less, until it becomes still all by itself. The next simile, which I also did, I will need someone to... Did I do this yesterday? No, I don't think I did it here. Must have been in Melbourne. I need... Datuk Victor, you are a well-respected member of the community, and you can be perfectly trusted. Could you please stand up? Now, the water in my cup represents my mind. I am now going to keep my mind perfectly still. So I'm going to hold the water perfectly still. Can you please tell me when the water has stopped moving?
It has not stopped moving.
Okay, so I will concentrate. It's not helping. Is it moving more?
Yeah, it is moving.
Exactly. When you concentrate, it moves more. I really try hard. I put effort in now. Yeah. Now that's how many people meditate. They try to concentrate, they put effort trying to stop their mind moving, and it never works. You get frustrated, many of you give up. There's a very easy way to keep this glass of water perfectly still. You let it go. You renounce it. Give up trying. Leave it alone. Now, how's that? Amazing. A big round of applause for my assistant. Thank you. Now, that's what we mean by renouncing, letting go. So just like the banana, your mind doesn't belong to you. Let it go. Put it down. Detach. And then you'll find it becomes still all by itself. That's called renouncing. Nekama. I've got to be careful because it's 55 minutes and I've only gone through one of them. The next one is kindness. And the kindness is please be kind to your poor body and poor mind. Which is why if you're having a hard time, if you are suffering, there's two methods to use if you're having a hard day. Number one, can you please raise your right hand? Everyone raise your right hand. Now please put it to your head. There, poor me. I'm okay. Stroke yourself. Give yourself a bit of kindness. And number two, put out both your arms.
Now bring them in and in.
If no one else will hug you, hug yourself. Oh, I love me. Ooh, that's nice. It's amazing how a little bit of kindness like that takes away a lot of pain, a lot of stress, a lot of unhappiness. Now try that. It actually works. It's not just a joke. If you're ever having a hard day, get your hands out and give yourself a hug. If you're having a bad meditation day, nothing works, give yourself a hug and say, it's okay, Ajahn Brahm, nobody's perfect, you're alright. Because what you're doing with that kindness is another form of letting go. It brings up happiness, energy and peace. The sorts of things which we want in this life. Compassion in life is again all about giving people the benefit of the doubt. You don't know why they did that to you, but be kind. They must be having a bad day. That's why they said such things to you. That's why they did such bad. You must have been doing a very, very bad day. And that's so true. Husbands and wives, if your husband comes home and scolds you, it's nothing to do with you. It's because they've had a very hard day at work. And they're just like what they call venting. They're letting go of their anger at someone they hope will understand. It's nothing to do with you. They're just in a bad mood. And if they're in a bad mood, you just give them a big hug. You don't need to scold them back, because that just makes things worse. So give that loving kindness. And in this path of Buddhism, it's not just loving kindness to people. It's loving kindness to yourself. You poor thing, you've been meditating all day. And some of you have been so frustrated, you're probably wondering, how am I going to last another 7 days? Oh my goodness, it's only what day is it today? Sunday, another 7 days to go, I'm not going to make this. No, be kind to yourself. You've done a very good job. That's why that I developed my loving kindness so much. I never ever criticize anybody. That's why those of you who've come into the interviews, have I ever criticized you? You come in and say, oh, my meditation is terrible. And I say, very good. You come in and say, I've been sleeping all the time. And I say, very good. You come in and say, I decided to convert to Christianity. And I say, very good. You know, it's great fun doing that. In fact, that's so well known in my monastery that now they say, I don't need to do interviews anymore. They just need to have some statue or some robot. And you come in and tell all the problems, and I say, very good. Because you know, that's all people really want, a bit of kindness and support, to realize there's nothing wrong with you. You're doing the right thing. It's only a matter of time, and you get the meditation. So it doesn't matter where you are, it's all very good. And you're loved, and you're respected, and you're supported. What a wonderful thing that is. You're never, ever criticized. That's why I remember there's a few people. One of the monks I first learned this from was a monk called Ajahn Tate, a very lovely monk. Of course, he's dead now, but of all the monks I ever met who actually looked like an arahant, fully enlightened, he was the one. Just so peaceful. And he had this aura about him. When I first went to see him to ask my questions on meditation or about Buddhism, I was scared. I was scared because I was sure that this monk could read your mind. And my mind was not ready to be read yet at all. But when I went in to see him, you had this wonderful feeling that here was a person who would never ever criticize you, who would never ever hurt you. And that was such a wonderful feeling, to feel so safe, so respected, so loved. I had that feeling for the first time. I don't want to move from here. I just want to sit here in this room, just gazing at this monk for the rest of my life. Because you felt so safe, and that was so rare in the world. How rare is it that you can be with someone and you feel perfectly safe? You don't have to defend yourself. You're not going to get criticized. You're just going to be accepted and loved for who you are, even though you're stupid. You don't have to be smart and clever. Oh, what a relief. I went so peaceful and so still, I forgot all my questions. I just wanted to sit. And that what somebody said to me afterwards, they've got this simile of the spikes. The simile of the spikes goes like this. Many people have got invisible spikes coming out of their body. And they're really sharp. Some people's spikes are so long and so sharp, you get even close to them and you get scratched. You know the sort of people I'm talking about? You don't even want to be in the same room with them. You get too close into their personal space and you get hurt. Those are the people with long, sharp spikes. Most people have got invisible spikes. They're not that long, but you get too close to them and you get hurt. There are some beautiful people in this world who've only got tiny spikes. You can go out with them, you can be close to them, but you get too close and then you get scratched. And there are a few very rare people in this world who've got no spikes at all. These are the beautiful, loving arahats, enlightened beings. Without any spikes, you can get as close as you like, and you always feel 100% safe, respected, and loved. You don't have to do anything. The love comes without any conditions. And it's very rare to find people like that, and if you find people like that, you never want to leave. So this is what we mean by loving kindness. Because you have this beautiful sense of acceptance and love, you never want to leave. I just want to sit there forever. If you have that attitude to your mind just wants to sit next to you forever, and you never ever have any restlessness. The only reason why in meditation you are restless is because you don't have enough metta in your meditation. If you had enough loving kindness, your mind wouldn't always be trying to escape from you, trying to run away because it's scared you may hurt it. Have this beautiful sense of loving kindness. Mind, I love you so much. You can do whatever you want. The door of my heart is open to you, mind. If you fall asleep and have the most weird sexual fantasies, it doesn't matter, mind, I still love you. It's amazing just how that creates so much peace in your mind. Because that loving kindness is another way of letting go. The door of my heart is open to you. No matter who you are, no matter what you do, no matter where you go. That's what we mean by love. Unconditional, no strings attached, no demands. Loving your meditation, no matter what it's like. Sometimes it's like counterintuitive. We think if we were going to get peaceful, we have to do something. But no, love, loving kindness. Allow this moment to be no matter what it is. Open the door of your heart to this moment no matter what it is. And then you're peaceful. Then things don't disappear. They stay with you. They don't run away. Remember, the only reason why you have restlessness in meditation is because of not being content enough, not being happy enough. The loving kindness creates that happiness. So have this beautiful sense of acceptance and love. That is the second part of right intention. And the third part of right intention is non-violence, gentleness. So please, all you people meditating, please don't do violence to your body. If it hurts, move. There was one monk I grew up with, he's now an abbot in England. He decided to sit through pain. He was meditating one night and his knees started to hurt. No, I am not going to move. I'm going to sit here even though it hurts. This is enlightenment or bust. You know what happened? Bust. He had to have a double knee reconstruction in hospital, poor thing. That's really stupid. If it hurts, move. It's kindness. I always think, what would the Buddha say? The Buddha would say, oh, you poor thing, please move. If you've got an itch, the Buddha would probably say, let me scratch it for you. The Buddha was a compassionate and kind person. Was very gentle. We don't do violence in Buddhism. We don't do wars. That's not part of our tradition. But I see many people meditating who do violence to their body. They sit here, I'm not going to move. Even in some traditions, they get this big stick. And if you're nodding, whack! Should we do that? No! I went to a retreat once, you know it really works. I went to a Zen retreat once when I was young, because there was not many places I could go on retreat. And it was this was in 1970 or something, there was only about 12 of us in this hall, facing the wall, when the master came with the stick. I always had good karma. I was always very lucky. Even though I was sleepy, the guy next to me was more sleepy than I was. So he was the one who got hit. And right next to you, went whack! And as soon as I heard that, all my sleepiness vanished. It was gone. So fear made me fully awake. But that's nothing to do with Buddhism, that type of violence. So don't be violent to your mind. If it wants to go off, go to sleep, be gentle with it. It's all right, mind, you can do that. That gentleness, that lack of violence, is a beautiful part of meditation. And if you do that gentleness in your life, you no need to be violent. I don't never punish my monks when they do things wrong. I never hit them with a stick. I find that gentleness and kindness are far more effective in getting the monks who live with me to actually to do the right thing. They've made a mistake, they come up to me, and I always do the AFL code. Acknowledge you've made a mistake. Forgive, it's amnesty. And learn to make sure that you don't do it again. That's all you need to do. There's no need for violence. The same in your meditation. If you make a mistake, acknowledge, yes, you went in the wrong direction. Just forgive it. No punishment. And then learn, so you don't need to do it again. And that's called growth. So we don't have violence. So that, in brief, is the three right intentions of letting go, being kind, and being gentle. And we all know, we should know, that when it comes to the law of karma, the Buddha said that intention is karma. Cetanahaṃ kāmaṃ vadāmi, said the Buddha. The intention is the most important part of karma. So, if you want to make good meditation karma, then in every moment of your meditation, please let go, be kind, be gentle. You are making good karma. And if you have faith in the law of karma, it means eventually you will get the fruit of that good karma. You will find peace, bliss, all the deep meditations and enlightenment, because karma is the cause. Instead of letting go, sometimes I say to make peace. It's another way of saying let go. Make peace means not controlling. So very often I've told people in meditation, what you need to do is just to make peace, be kind and be gentle. That's all. And sometimes people say, where did that come from? That is the second factor of the Eightfold Path. So if you want to meditate well, remember the Eightfold Path. Remember right intention, good meditation karma. And that's all you ever need to do. Whatever you're experiencing, make peace. Let go. Be kind. Be gentle. And that's the best you can possibly do. So when people ask me at any stage of the meditation, whether you've still got a sore body, whether you are sleepy, whether you're thinking a lot, whether you can't watch anything, they say, oh, I can't meditate. I say, can you make peace with how you feel? Can you be kind to it? Open the door of your heart to my sleepiness. Can you be gentle? If you can do those three things, then you can meditate. And that is what meditation actually is. Meditation is not scanning the body. It's not watching the breath. It's not watching the nimittas or kasinas. That's not meditation. That's what happens when you meditate. But what you actually do is making peace, being kind, and being gentle with whatever you experience in this moment. And you wouldn't believe how powerful that is. That's all I ever do when I meditate. I don't try and get anywhere. I don't try and be mindful. I don't try and do anything except making peace with this moment. Make peace with it, not war. I'm just so kind to this moment. Whatever moment it is, I say, very good. And I'm so gentle. You see, that's the way I live my life. That's the way I relate to you. That's the way I relate to my meditation. Just making peace, being kind, being gentle. And that's really all you need to know about meditation. And if you say, well, I'm sick, I can't meditate. Can you make peace with your sickness? Can you be kind? Can you be gentle? Then you can meditate. When you're dying on your deathbed, what should you do? Make peace, be kind, be gentle. That is the optimum you can ever do at any time, at any place. It's called right intention. It really is the heart of the Eightfold Path. It's actually what you do. And that leads to all the jhanas and enlightenment. So please, if you ever want to know how to meditate, people ask you how you meditate, please tell them, just make peace, be kind, and be gentle. You try that in the next few days. It's such an easy thing to do, and my goodness, it works. Thank you for listening. Okay. So, the questions, which I have to do very quickly today. Any questions about the talk so far? Good. Thank you so much for being kind. For making peace. Very good. Wow! We're not going to do this in a few seconds. No, I'll be kind. I'll do the ones on the bottom first of all. Wow, heat. Okay, first question. I've got a quarter of an hour to do these questions, so it's going to be... Would greeting and hugging close relations of opposite sex be breaking the precepts? No. If it's relations... Look, when my mother was still alive, now one of the things which really hurt her more than anything about her son being a monk, because she couldn't hug me. And when I first went back, I was very strict. And I said, no, Mum, you can't hug me. And she was so upset. And so I said, I remembered that loving kindness was most important. So I said, okay, Mum, I'll give you two hugs. One when I first come and one when I leave. And she did that at the airport, but I said, hold on a minute, Mum. And I looked around to make sure there was no Thai people or Sri Lankan people who would know, criticize me. Said, okay, coast is clear, hug. That was really nice to do. And after a while, because you know, when you first become a monk, you're very, very careful and you don't really understand why those precepts are there. If it's your old mum, I mean, for goodness sake, it's your mother, for goodness sake, so just give her a hug. So that's okay. Hugging close relations of opposite sex be breaking the precepts, yeah. An old mum is not going to cause you any problems. And in fact, it's really wrong if you don't. But if it's your ex-wife, no. Dear Ajahn, with financial constraints, kindly advise as a parent, what is the right action to take so that children would understand our good intention is further growth to be a useful, independent, loving and caring adults. Parents to work harder to support their unlimited wants and desires, including university studies and PhD, or just provide them their basic needs and let them work through to earn and complete their further studies, etc. That's what I had to do, because my father died when I was 16, my mother was really poor, and I had scholarships, but the scholarship wasn't enough to pay your way for university, so I got jobs. That gave me a great sense of independence and responsibility. You know, I had to learn, because that's the only way I could survive. So sometimes if you bring up your children, as they say, in cotton wool, and you provide everything for them, they miss the opportunities of learning independence, responsibility. So even if you have got lots of money, still send your kids out to, you know, do these be paper rounds, working here, working there, odd jobs around the house, so they could earn their money. So don't just give it to them. You know, if you want to sort of have some money, son, you know, clean the car or whatever else it is. And that, you know, means they actually do something for the money. So that's a wonderful way of teaching them some responsibility. So don't just give them stuff. And that way they realize that, you know, if you do need to sort of get some money to pay your bills, then you have to sort of, you know, do some work for it, which is training them. That's what I would say anyway. And I'm an expert on this, having had so many kids in my life. I don't know why people ask me about bringing up kids. Could you describe a nimitta? The nimitta is go outside this evening, look at a headlight. That's a nimitta right there. A beautiful flash, but it stays there in your mind. So thank you for giving me a nimitta. That's the next one. But I'll go into nimittas later on. I always have tremendous ache in my legs during meditation after every 20 minutes, regardless of the posture I have. I understand we should be compassionate towards our body, but if moving the legs into a more comfortable position every 20 minutes, will that shake my concentration? Do I still have to do it? Look, take your legs off so they don't hurt. Get them amputated. No, don't amputate them. Find a chair to sit on or get some more cushions. Change your posture this way and that way until you can find a comfortable one. Look, the person who asked that question, have you ever watched a movie? How long does a movie take? 2 hours. Can you watch a movie? What do you do when you're watching a movie? Sometimes you're not paying any attention to the legs. It's such an important movie. Oh my goodness, that's a whole hour. I should have moved my legs by then. Even going to the toilet. You know, it's such a good movie. Oh, but I've got to wait to see. And it's amazing what you can endure when you really have to. So a lot of times, that if you just make peace, be kind, be gentle, forget about it. You're not going to sort of get any trouble with your legs. But if you have to move, but after a while you find a lot of times it's the mind. Remember that when you watch a movie or watch the soccer or anything else you like, you can sit for hours. But in meditation, you can only sit for 20 minutes because you're not enjoying yourself. Not enough loving kindness. My grandmother passed away 3 years ago. I still have recurring dreams of her. Is it because she has not been reborn as asking for merits? Unlikely. Unless your grandmother was a bad girl. Was she a bad girl? Probably not. All it is because you have attachment to her, usually. So just move on in life. Let it go. It's not your grandmother. It's not the monkey's banana. There's many more people you have to love in this life. So please let that one go. It's very unlikely that she wants merits.
Dear Ajahn Brahm,
thank you for guiding us to an inspiring journey. So far to practice meditation, I've only just begun. However, I have some doubt on how to clearly know we have seen or experienced the nimitta. This is because the nimitta is what happens later on in meditation when especially the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching vanish. And then what's left is the mind. And the usual way we experience the mind is as a beautiful light. For those of you who know the Anapanasati Sutta, that's stage 9. Chittang Patisangvedi. You experience the mind as a beautiful light. The Buddha said the light is radiant. Pabhasara Chitta. When the defilements have gone. That's what you experience. It's beautiful light in your mind. The best time is when the five senses have disappeared. Sometimes the five senses haven't disappeared yet, but they are subdued. So the five senses are not very strong, but the mind is very strong. So it dominates, and that's what you see. And don't worry, every one of you will see the nimitta. If you don't see it while you're alive, you'll see it when you're dead. Have you ever heard people with these near-death experiences floating out of their body? And what happens next? They go to the light. That is exactly the same as what you see in meditation. Only, you know, you're alive. And when you see it, when you're dead, you know, you're dead. But what it is the mind manifests when the five senses shut down. That happens in death. That also happens in meditation. So you'll all see it sooner or later. Sooner better than later. And when you do see it in your meditation, because I've been teaching this for such a long time, this is one of my areas of expertise, 99% of the time when people think they see a nimitta, it really is a nimitta. So if you think you've seen a nimitta, the odds are heavily in your favor that it was a nimitta. So just trust yourself. Yes, that was a nimitta. Well done. Very good. But I'll tell more about that later on in the retreat, because that's, you know, more the deeper stuff. Dear Ajahn Brahm, why are some people born or are gay? Are they creating bad karma as their presence makes some people feel uncomfortable? No, the people who feel uncomfortable are making bad karma. Poor old gay people. So isn't it part of the Metta Sutta to say, may all beings be happy and well. There's no exceptions for gays. The Buddha never said, may all people be happy and well except gays. Did he ever say that? So look, I think Buddhism is very good in this area because we've always had such strong loving kindness of all religions. We accept people more than others, whoever you are, even if you are a person just released from jail. We love everybody to bits, no matter who you are, no matter what you've done, no matter what sexual orientation, whether you are female, male, or whatever. In fact, I've made a point of supporting gay rights in Australia, and I was never gay. I was afraid of gays when I was young, because I never understood them. Now, as a monk, you can open the door of your heart and understand that's just one way of expressing your sexuality in this world. And to respect that. I have some gays are the most wonderful people. And you know, some of the great people in our world have been gay, people like Tchaikovsky. He was one of my favorite composers when I was young. He was gay. What an amazing person he was. Brilliant. And there's so many other people who do amazing contributions to our world who are gay. That's just who they are. And they can't change. That's just who they are. Even it's natural, because you watch any, ask any zoologist, and there are even gay birds, there are gay dolphins. Throughout the whole of life on this planet, you find some proportion of the population of any animals are gays. So it's natural. And imagine a person who is gay. And probably a few of you here are gay. Well done. I love you to bits. You are also accepted totally as a Buddhist. Gays and lesbians, transgenders, you are accepted. What a wonderful thing it is to be accepted. Sometimes women understand gays better than men, because many of you women have been rejected and been second-class citizens for many years. You know what it feels like. You know, not to be given equal rights and respect, as if somehow a woman is somehow inferior to a man. Now you perhaps know how a gay person feels. They feel like you felt maybe 10, 20, 30 years ago. Maybe your mother's never had much of a chance in life. Maybe they were intelligent, but because they were female, they weren't given the opportunities. That's what gay people feel. Outsiders, rejected. And as a Buddhist, I will not stand for that. So, anyone who's born gay, welcome. And as far as Buddhism is concerned, you have totally equal rights. And I will stand up for you. In fact, these days, especially in the West, gays are accepted. The people who aren't accepted anymore, or still not accepted, are the celibates. It's true, because I remember seeing this interview from this lady in the United States, who said, oh, gays are okay, but celibacy is unnatural. And that's what they used to call the gays, that gay is unnatural. And now they say having no sex at all is unnatural. So I am going to ask for a float in the next Mardi Gras in Australia. Celibate rights. Equal treatment for celibates. So don't stop discriminating against people who don't want any sex. It's your choice. Dear Ajahn, if I take the 8 precepts, can I eat afternoon? In some temples, this is in Sri Lanka, they keep 13 precepts on these poya days. The poya days is the one prayer days, 4 times a month. Full moon, new moon, and half moons. Have you heard about the 13 precepts before? The 13 precepts, you keep 8 precepts in the morning and 5 precepts in the afternoon. Well, that's cheating! The 8 precepts, the biggest one is not eating in the afternoon, so you only keep that in the morning, so you don't have to do it. No, if it's 8 precepts, the day you keep 8 precepts, you shouldn't eat anything in the afternoon of that day, or at night time. You have to do it at least for 24 hours, otherwise it's no meaning at all. So you keep the 8 precepts. Quickly, I've got a few more minutes. In staying retreat, we are sort of separated from the outside world, so in a way there is less desire. But when we resume our daily lives after retreat, exposure to desires from the outside world start coming in. How do we sustain ourselves to achieve the similar experience we had in retreat? Easy, don't leave. Renounce, become a monk. Now you find that you go and retreat, your desires get lessened, especially your ill will gets lessened. Number one, it's not because, you know, you control the mind. It's because you're happy and peaceful and content. You don't need so many desires. One of the reasons, why do you go shopping? They call it shopping therapy. To overcome, you know, you're feeling grumpy, feeling ill, feeling bad. And that's why many people go shopping. But when you feel happy anyway, you don't need to go shopping. You're just happy being at home. Why do men go to, you know, parties or go looking for other mistresses? What do they do that for? Because they're unhappy. When they come on retreat, they're so content and so peaceful. They just give up all their mistresses. The girls give up all their shopping. The guy is richer. The woman is not so well worried. Because when you're content, you don't need so much. If you notice that all the advertisements, they create discontent. You haven't lived unless you've seen the Grand Canyon. You missed out on life unless you've driven a sports car. And all that creates discontent, which means you have to go and buy this and go there and do everything else. But here on a retreat, we create contentment. Just happy being here, which means when you go back, you don't have so much craving. You don't have so much ill will. You're a much easier person to live with. So we won't be able to abandon all those cravings and yearnings, but at least they'll be subdued for a long time, which means you can have a much more peaceful life. I know it would be bad for the economy, but nevertheless it would be good for you. In Ajahn Chah teaching, one should practice to become peaceful, like still flowing water in a forest. How can the mind be still and at the same time flowing? If meditation makes the mind still, what makes the still mind flowing? So, in other words, you are still, but the world is flowing. Just like I don't travel anywhere. I never move, I just sit down on the aircraft, and the aircraft moves. I don't walk, I don't fly, I just sit down and I'm perfectly still. The next thing you know, you land in KLIA. So I am still monk flying. And that's what happens, you're still just sitting here inside your body and mind, and the world passes by. But you are still as the whole world moves. A good simile of that, and which is very wonderful for your meditation, is sometimes when you have thoughts, feelings, emotions going on in the mind, in order to renounce, and this is another wonderful simile, remember the time you watched a movie, maybe in the old movie theatres. Because I remember going to the movies when I was young, and there'd be some movie on the screen, and people get so sucked into the movie that people in the audience would shout out, "Hey, behind you! They're creeping up on you!" And then actually, did you ever see that happen? And that, how can, it's a movie, they can't hear you. But still people shout out and give instructions as if the person could hear. That's called getting involved in the movie. But if you can remember, you're sitting in the armchair or in the seat in the movie theatre, and that's just lights going on the screen in front of you. You don't get so involved. Which means that when somebody dies, you don't cry. When the lovers meet, they run towards each other and they embrace you. Oh, isn't that nice? Oh. If you remember it's a movie, you can be peaceful. You can let it go. You don't get so involved. And for those of you meditating, all those thoughts in your mind, the only reason they keep going is because, just like a movie, you get involved in them. They're my thoughts. If you can just stand back and say, I'm sitting here in the chair, and these are just thoughts like going on the TV screen, on the movie screen, then you find you don't get so involved. You can let them go very easily and they soon stop. But when you get involved in them, they're interesting, just like the movie. 2 hours goes by, wasting your time. So that's how we let go. Another quick one. Bhikkhu Bodhi, in his book, In the Buddha's Words, mentioned that to reach the attainment of stream entry, the aspiring disciple should cultivate the four factors leading to stream entry. He further mentions that at the peak of the training, when insight reaches its peak, the disciple's understanding will undergo a major transition, which marks the entry upon the fixed course of rightness, the true Noble Eightfold Path that leads to irreversible Nibbana. Can you please explain what the Bhikkhu Bodhi meant by the fixed course of rightness above? Yes, he meant making peace, being kind, being gentle. When you understand what's going on, you understand there's no self in here. So this will business, that is a problem. So that's what happens when you understand stream winning. No one in here. So you can't do anything when there's no one in here to do things. So that's what we mean by making peace. Being kind, being gentle. Letting go of the control freak. There's no one in there. So shut up and be peaceful. Please let me know when we should stop. There's quite a few more in the biscuit tin. Ajahn Brahm, how does one feel in samadhi? Wonderful. Oh, give me more. Oh, this is brilliant. It is the bliss better than sex. That's how it feels. Are you interested? And that's actually true. I'll probably mention that later on when I get into the deep meditations. Dear Ajahn, during meditation when I relax my body for a while, I feel comfortable. But after a moment, the body will start to shake, swing from right to left or left to right. Shall I let it be and why? Yeah, please let it be, but please tell the people sitting next to you to move a bit further away. We don't want them to get injured. Other than that, you can please let it happen. Because it's just a body doing its thing. Sometimes it needs to move that way just to get energy going from it. Or sometimes it's actually stored up stress being released. Dear Ajahn, we are going to die alone. You never know. If you die in an aircraft, you die with lots of other people. And the flight attendants are with you to look after you as you die. That's not a nice place to die. If it was the end of the world, we'd all die together. So we're going to die alone. It's necessary to come to terms with our basic aloneness, to be comfortable with it. The mind can become strong and peaceful in understanding, making possible a beautiful communion with others. Please explain. Thank you. Yeah, I told you this morning, I spent 6 months in solitude, never speaking to another human being, never seeing anybody for 6 whole months. But I was never alone. There was always somebody there. And that was me. Wherever I go, here I am again. Now, I went all the way to Kuala Lumpur, and here I am again. I took me with me. Wherever I go, I can't escape from me. A lot of time, that's what people do. They take alcohol and drugs to try and escape. When they come down from the drugs, when they sober up, they're back with themselves again. The one person you can never escape from. You can leave your husband, your wife, you can run away from your parents. The one person you never run away from is yourself. So a long time ago I realized the most important relationship I would ever have is a relationship with myself. So I learned how to forgive myself, be kind to myself, and open the door of my heart to myself totally. Even the dark side, the side which I wasn't really happy with, all the wrong things I did as a kid, that can come in as well. So it's like uniting the whole of yourself, your whole history. Now that's an interesting part which would benefit a whole talk. Sometimes people have been through some great tragedies in life. Being raped, being cheated, having terrible accidents. And they try and get rid of that part of their life. And they never can. And they never should either. That is part of who you are. So instead of trying to get some psychologist or some monk to get rid of that as if it never happened, no. You bring that in. Embrace it. You don't get rid of it. You transform it. And that's what acceptance actually does. That's part of you. And that's what we mean by opening the door of your heart to all of you, even the difficult parts which happen. And I teach this to victims of torture and trauma, refugees who come to Australia who've been through stuff which will make your skin creep. Terrible stuff has happened to them. And I tell them, I can never wave a magic wand and make that stuff go away. It never will go away. You have to bring that inside yourself. Open the door of your heart to that as well. And when you stop rejecting it, but accept it, then it becomes transformed. And it's no longer a problem. It's rejecting it is the problem. Making peace, being kind, being gentle, embracing it. That is the solution. That's why monks like me are the ones who teach psychologists. That's where all this stuff comes from. Because we understand the nature of the mind. Whatever's happened to you in your life, don't have part of it which you try and imagine never happened. It did happen. Accept it, embrace it. That's who you are. And when you stop trying to get rid of it, then the problem has stopped. During meditation, how should I stop myself from slouching? Follow my example. Slouch to the max. Because when you slouch to the max, the body is doing what the body needs to do. So if it feels like slouching, slouch. I remember slouching once, and I had my body right in front of me, and it was just bending over. And then I just noticed it straightened up all by itself. I never did anything. That was the first time I realized this body, it knows what to do. If it wants to straighten up, it will straighten up. So you just leave it, let go, let the body decide what it needs to do. Okay, one last? 5 more minutes, okay. I told her when I ran a conference once in Perth, we had the 10 minutes, 5 minutes, and then the gun. That's the only way to run a conference, Victor. Sada. Ajahn, how can one curb anger when it arises and fast? It's easy to overcome anger. You just let it come, let it go. The door of your heart has two parts to it. You can go in a door, and you can also go out as well. So all that stuff, let it come in and let it go out. So that's how you let go of anger. But a lot of times, a lot of anger becomes because you control so much. When you control, you become frustrated. Because sometimes you fail to control. Your husband doesn't do what he's supposed to do. The monk doesn't do what he's supposed to do. He keeps on speaking beyond 9:30. But you can't control these things. So just let it go. Only people who are control freaks get angry. The more control freak they are, the more angry they get. When you just let go, you don't get angry anymore. So things go wrong in my life as well, but I expect them to go wrong. When people don't turn up, when the plane is late, when people don't do what they're supposed to do, I expected that. Because that's human nature. When I expect it, I don't get angry. But when you think, Ajahn Brahm shouldn't be like that. Victor, he's a datuk. He should be much better than that. No, poor old Victor. It's so hard being... So no, just be yourself and relax. And don't have such high expectations. Lower your expectations. And then you don't get so angry. Especially lower your expectations of wives. They're all the same. I've known many in my life. Not my own wives, but I've married many others. They're all the same, so what do you expect? They all spend too much. That's the nature. My intention is always to help or do as much as I could offer. However, there are times, in fact, often, friends started taking advantage. For example, paying for meals, doing chores, and so on. At times I feel very angry and ask why. Because that's what they're like. And if they take advantage of you, you keep taking advantage of me. And I'm very happy. That's what I'm here for. To be exploited. Exploit me. Take advantage. Because that you get so much fun. Being taken advantage of. Being exploited. Because that's your life to give. The more you give, the more happiness you have. But if you expect something back in return, you lose all of the happiness. Just like I've seen, just in the back wall over there. All the people who donated. They got all their names on there. That's not donations. That's not charity. That's advertising. So-and-so gave so much. So real donations, real giving is expecting nothing back in return. Expecting to be exploited. Taken advantage of. So that's, I love that, just giving. And I don't care. I don't expect anything back. And I don't ever get anything back either sometimes. At times I feel angry and ask why. Then I get confused. Should I just do my part and be wise rather than suffering or getting upset? Don't just do your part. Do more than your part. That's why I taught this to the monks in monastery over in Perth. And when it's time to do a chore, there's a competition. Please let me do it. No, you did it last time. I want to do it. And they fight to do more work. Because they realize it's opportunities to do karma. Good karma. So please, let me feed the monk. No, you fed it last time. I want to do it. I want to wash up. No, you did the washing up last time. It's my turn. I want to clean the toilets. No, I'm doing cleaning the toilets today. And you get up early and clean them before. Ha ha ha, I caught you. I done the toilets first. Now that is great fun. When I learned this, the last 5 minutes, last story, as many of you here will do this tomorrow, Ajahn Chah's feet. Because it used to be the tradition in Thailand, because we used to go on arms round without any shoes on, your feet would get dirty. Before you came into a hall, you'd have to wash your feet. And if it was a teacher, monks would wash his feet for him. And when I saw this, coming from a place like England, I thought, why do people have to wash this man's feet? He's old enough to wash his own feet. And this was just too much culture and tradition. But it wasn't just one person washing his feet. About 20 monks would rush up, and he'd had about 10 monks on each foot. And I thought that was so inefficient. So what I decided I should do was have a roster. That's how you do it. So you're rostered on today to wash your feet. You're the next day. You're the next day. That made sense. That's how we do things in the West. We organize it. Just like you have the roster for washing up here. Now that is not the way to do it. He never had a roster. It was just the fastest was the one who washed the feet. So I was always a scientist. I decided to do an experiment. I couldn't understand this. So the only way to understand it is do it yourself. And you had to be fast. So I was poised like a cat. Come back early, waiting to see Ajahn Chah. And as soon as I saw him, I rushed up, as with many other monks. But I was fast enough, I got a toe all to myself. And I felt so happy washing the toe of Ajahn Chah. And I always remember that to this day. And then I realized why people do this. I got so much happiness washing the toe of my master. And I understand what giving really is. You give, and it's not because the person needs it, because I need to give. And you do it not because it needs doing, but because you need to give. And when I understood that, I understood why so many people get so much happiness after washing the feet of a monk who could wash it for himself. That was not the point. So if you really want to have a lot of fun tomorrow, you get there and wash the dishes before anybody else. It doesn't matter if it's not your turn. You just do that because it's fun to do, to help, to serve, to look after other people. That's one of the great ways of having happiness. So before I get shot, we do the sharing of merits, and then we have to go. Idamenyatina hot sukita hontu yatayo Idam meniatina hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Idam meniatina hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu.
Very good. Any announcements before we go to bed? Okay, off you go. Good night. Sleep well. See you in the morning if you're still alive.